MSW Media.
Great barroom chat. You know, they love telling that story. And then what happened? Because generally, journalism is better in bars than it is in papers anyway.
Prevail. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimen organizado, dinero sucio.
Globalu corrupciju. Та боротьбу за демократію.
І ahora.
А тепер.
І maintenant.
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Грегор.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Roan Tempest is here. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. The Prevail column on Substack has been going since November of 2019. Lots of good stuff in the archives about Leonard Leo, Jared Kushner, Putin, Trump, Russia, Ukraine, and much, much more. Every piece of Prevail is free to read and always will be. No paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions are just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. For 26 years, Roan Tempest was the national and foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Based in Paris, New Delhi, Beijing, Hong Kong, and the craziest capital city, Sacramento. After his retirement, he worked for ProPublica and was the co-founder of the Wyoming nonprofit public policy news site, Wyofile. He's taught journalism at Berkeley, his alma mater, won numerous awards. He's also the author of two books, including The Last Western, The Unjustified Killing of Michael Rosa by Ed Cantrell. Now in Salt Lake City, he lived for many years in the foothills of the Wind River Mountains outside of Lander, Wyoming. I asked Roan to come on the show because he wrote a fantastic profile at Wyofile. Profile at Wyofile. That's hard to say. Of Kevin Roberts. Who is Kevin Roberts? Kevin Roberts is the head of the Heritage Foundation. What is the Heritage Foundation? One of this old, august kind of conservative think tank groups. It's been around for a long time. It was very instrumental in 79, early 80s to jumpstart kind of the Reagan presidency and the policies that Reagan imposed during especially his first term. Now it's trying to do the same thing in a proposed second Trump term, and it's scary, scary stuff. I don't know if you've heard about Project 2025. I've talked about it maybe a little bit on this podcast. We've talked about it on the 5-8. I've written about it on my Substack. If you don't know what Project 2025 is, you should know, and so should all of your friends before this election happens, because it's scary stuff. Remember in 2016 when Trump came in and he put Rex Tillerson in charge of state, and they basically fired a bunch of people, and it was kind of this clean out of that department, and it really weakened our ability to do stuff for a long time, and everybody was kind of mad about it, and then we moved on to the next thing. Project 2025 is basically the same thing writ large. So I wrote a piece about this. I'm going to read from it a little bit. Under the guidance of Kevin Roberts, Roberts organized this Project 2025 Presidential Transition Project, a plan for, quote, institutionalizing Trumpism, as he told the New York Times, quote, the Trump administration with the best of intentions simply got a slow start, and Heritage and our allies in Project 2025 believe that must never be repeated, end quote. Those allies, which are listed in the front of the book, they've written this big book called Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. It's this 940-page book that they've put out helpfully on their website for free, so you can go look at it yourself. The allies that he's talking about, which are listed in the front of the book, include a healthy chunk of Leonard Leo-affiliated organizations. Tom Carter told me on the Prevail podcast a few weeks ago, there are 80 different groups involved in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. Leonard has ties to 40 of them, so it's a lot. Leonard Leo, you don't know if you haven't listened to this before, is the radical Catholic dark money maestro who captured the Supreme Court. He's like friends with Clarence Thomas and found Sam Alito and basically engineered him being installed there, and Roberts, and of course the three Trump nominees. The fruit of the presidential transition project labor is this book, this Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise, which is sort of a Baedeker for how to quickly, neatly, and radically lurch the federal government from republic to Orban-style Christo-fascist autocracy. Roberts, like so many Christian conservatives, loves him some Hungarian illiberal democracy. Among its 400 contributors are Trump administration retreads Ezra Cohen Watnick, Christopher Miller, remember him, the Secretary of Defense during the insurrection, Ken Cuccinelli, Rick Dearborn, John Ratcliffe, Anthony Tata, and Peter Navarro, who's now off to prison. There's also Leonard Leo Associates, Roger Severino and Austin Roos, NRX hero Richard Hanania, and Ginny Thomas bestie and subpoena dodger Cleta Mitchell, best known for being on that phone call when Donald Trump asked Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to scrounge up votes. So, you know, it's the whole MAGA brain trust. In the book's foreword, Kevin Roberts invokes battlefield terminology, calling the contents of the tome, quote, the opening salvo of the 2025 presidential project. He writes, quote, its 30 chapters lay out hundreds of clear and concrete policy recommendations for White House offices, cabinet departments, Congress, and agencies, commissions, and boards, unquote. And in case anyone misses the point, he adds, this is an agenda prepared by and for conservatives who will be ready on day one of the next administration to save our country from the brink of disaster, end quote. Make no mistake, if Trump were to be reelected, he would install these loyalists and implement these policies. A second incoming Trump administration, unlike the first one, would be immediately purged of anyone who did not put FPOTUS over country, and they'd impose all of this stuff right quick, shock doctrine style, before we knew what hit us. At least, that's the conservative promise's promise. To get a taste of what the new America might look like, we need only peruse Kevin Roberts' foreword to the book, which basically is like Margaret Atwood fan fiction. Project 2025 seeks to undo all the progress made in the country since basically the McKinley assassination. So I call it a counter-reformation, because Heritage is pushing back on 12 decades of popular reforms that have made all of our lives better, including theirs. Roberts and company want to mortally wound government regulation, claw back civil rights advancements, eliminate numerous federal agencies, do away with all that woke New Deal stuff, and replace the brain trust at the CDC and the NIH and NASA and DARPA with, quote, parents at a high school football game in Waco, Texas, unquote. So, yeah, this is scary stuff, and I encourage you to go read it for yourself. Especially if you're, you know, a woman, gay, trans, person of color, a liberal in any way, shape, or form, anybody that values your liberty, just go read the thing, you know, don't take my word for it, go read it yourself. So Roan Tempest wrote a wonderful profile of this guy, this Kevin Roberts, because I think that understanding what's going on with Project 2025 and what the country would look like under a second Trump term means we have to understand Kevin Roberts, who's the guy that organized all of this. And Kevin Roberts, as it happened, used to live next door to Roan Tempest in Lander, Wyoming. So Roan knew him for years before he knew him in this capacity and was kind of shocked that, oh my God, this guy's going to be news. So this is the first ever profile of Kevin Roberts that anyone had ever written. And it's an excellent profile because it's very objective and above board. It's not, you know, taking cheap shots at the guy like I do. You know, it's real good journalism, and I encourage everybody to read that. I will put it in the show notes as well. So we talk obviously about Roberts. That's why I asked him on, but he's had such an interesting career as Roan Tempest that I wanted to get his thoughts about other things as well. So we talk about China. We talk about Afghanistan. It tells a great story about this couple things in Afghanistan, which is fascinating stuff. We talk about Wyoming and Wyoming politics, because it puzzles me, the whole thing there about Liz Cheney getting like suddenly 86th and Matt Gaetz showed up, remember, and was like, you need to renounce Liz Cheney. And then everyone in Wyoming listened to Matt Gaetz for some reason. It's very strange. So I wanted to get his take on that. And then we talked about Kevin Roberts in the interview and what the guy's like and all that stuff kind of at the end. So this is a great discussion. I really enjoyed talking to Roan. You know, really appreciate him coming on the show and sharing his thoughts with us, and encourage you to check out, you know, Wyofile, which he is the co-founder of, and also his book, which I, you know, if you like cold cases kind of things, it's really good, really interesting. He kind of delves into this murder that happened in 1979 in like a parking lot in Wyoming about, you know, two cops, one who shoots the other cop. And fascinating stuff if you like that kind of thing. Very well written. So anyway, very grateful to Roan Tempest for joining me. I've got nothing further up top other than one quick thing, which is the RNC has now been completely taken over by like Laura Trump and all of these Trump people. That's basically what's going to happen to the entire government if Trump gets reelected. We're going to see like his, you know, in-laws and kids and everything in these positions, and it's going to be just a walking shit show, among all the other horrible things. So please, for the love of God, tell your friends how awful this guy is. It's really important that we get the word out. Anyway, enough of my prattle. We'll be right back with Roan Tempest.
Oh, Nancy Mace, I see your face too often on TV. It would be a disgrace if Congresswoman Mace were chosen Trump's VP. Oh, Nancy Mace, you've lost the base, so please quit and go home. Please vanish, Nancy Mace, without a freaking trace. Let Trump pick Kristi Noem.
Roan Tempest, welcome to Prevail.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to have you today. You wrote a piece in Wyofile that was a profile of Kevin Roberts, who is the new-ish head of the Heritage Foundation, which is in the news, or should be in the news a lot lately because of this Project 2025. I thought it was a wonderful profile. It's easily the best one I've read anywhere. And I wanted to have you on to talk about him and that and his background in Wyoming. But before we go there, you know, your background is interesting and relevant to a lot of things that are happening in the news right now. You, for 26 years, you were a national and foreign correspondent for the LA Times. So you were posted a bunch of different places. You covered a lot of different countries. You also wrote a book called The Last Western: Unjustified Killing of Michael Rosa by Ed Cantrell, which is very good. You know, pacing good. Along. You're a good writer. That's it. You should go into writing, I think. I think you should consider
Maybe
it
I
as
will.
A you should consider it as a career.
When I turn 80, I think I'll do that.
But just because people are journalists doesn't mean they're good writers. You know, there's two different things, yeah. Kind of. So you are a good journalist and a good writer, which is, I think, nice. A nice combination when it can be found. So I did have you on originally because I wanted to talk about Kevin Roberts, and I do want to talk about that. But we'll get to that in the second part of the discussion today. I want to start with someplace you were posted, which is China. You were in China covering the death of Deng Xiaoping. You were there for the Hong Kong handover. So you're familiar with historically what the ebbs and flows of the place. What do you see now going on with China, with Xi? It seems like he's becoming more and more dictatorial and the people are becoming more and more unhappy. Is he in a position of weakness or strength, or, you know, what's your take on China right now?
Well, I'm hesitant to talk about China because it changes. I mean, I was back in China the last time in 2007, I guess, with my class. I was teaching a course at the University of California, and I took my students over there. And this is after having lived there for 6 years, and I could barely get around because things had changed so much.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The bottom line, though, I think is that, well, I'll give you an example. I once did a big comparison of the development of India and China, which was I'd been posted in India before, and how those two different systems served the people was really of interest to me. And so I did a kind of a developmental comparison side by side. And it was basically showed that China had moved a lot quicker than India in many ways. And what the example that was used was that I had a friend who was the Indian ambassador to China, who I knew when we were in New Delhi. And I went and saw him, and he said, it's so frustrating. He said, you know, they've just built the fifth ring road around the city since I've been here at Beijing. And we're still building a bridge between old and New Delhi. There is a lot of that kind of comparison. China is, I don't think it's as horrible as it's being portrayed as the bête noire of the world right now. I think it's too dependent on us as a market. I think if you read something like, for example, if you read the history of the development of the electric car in China, there's been a lot of things about how they're building more electric cars than anybody else, but they're doing it for the Chinese market right now. They haven't branched out from that. Also, the biggest investor in their China electric car project was Warren Buffett. He got it off the line. So, you know, these trade relationships are really important, and we're still a huge market for them. I don't think that Xi could survive by poisoning that relationship, trade relationship. And it goes deeper than politics. Now, all of this gunboat diplomacy and the issue of Taiwan. Taiwan is also dependent on the mainland, you know, and there's divisions within Taiwan. I just don't see a war happening there. And I'm not as worried about China as a threat as other people. Now, maybe it's changed, you know, it changes so rapidly. You know, when I first went to China, they were just sort of opening up to the outside. And they would send these diplomats over to foreign missions, and they would still have the labels on their coats. They didn't know how to, you know, they weren't very polished. A few years later, I see a delegation, and they all look like they were, you know, dressed in Paris. And, you know, they spoke several languages. Its ability to move ahead and to change the native intelligence of the Chinese people, I will never underestimate. The paradox of China is that, you know, they go through things like the Wenhua Dagami and the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. And, you know, they act completely crazy. And they are susceptible to, I think they're really susceptible to manipulation on issues like Taiwan. If the government feels that they're threatened and they want to raise that, I suppose they could do it and manipulate the population. But I'm just not as afraid of China as I guess the majority of our foreign policy experts are.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I know nothing about it, really. It's not at all my area of expertise, but it seems like we owe them so much money. Like, why? What are they going to do? I mean, it's not. And I feel like invading Taiwan is a, you know, it's a huge amphibious kind of operation that would be horrifying for both sides. And, you know, why, ultimately? The kind of the rhetorical promise of doing that is always going to be something that they can run on, sort of like, you know, the Republicans running on the border. It's just this perpetual thing. And if the border ever were fully closed, then they wouldn't be able to run on it anymore. So therefore, it's unlikely to happen. That's my thinking about it, too. So, yeah.
No, I agree with you. I actually agree with you.
I'm glad, because that makes me feel less afraid of the future. So before we started recording, you mentioned also that you were in France. You were, you know, covered France, and you said there were parallels between China and France. So what did you mean? But what were you doing there, and what did you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting, and it's something that I sort of developed as I was doing the research on the Kevin Roberts piece that you mentioned. But you know, I was in France at the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution, and I was also there when they, for the first time, allowed public money to be used to support parochial education. And so essentially that was the end of the French Revolution 200 years later. And the one thing that I learned, and then also learned from the reading that I did for the Roberts piece, is that cultural revolutions are really difficult. They're dangerous. They veer out of control. And, you know, when the French Revolution happened, you know, they changed the number of days of the week. They changed the names of the months. They did a bunch of pronoun changes and all sorts of other things that they did that were disastrous and then had to be, you know, rescinded later on. China's Cultural Revolution was a cultural revolution. It truly was. It was led by young people, a very dangerous thing. And I know that because I was in Berkeley. In the late 60s, I was in Berkeley. So I remember all of us sitting around talking about revolution after revolution. And that was, it horrifies me now to think that these people that I was talking about, they were mainly interested in getting laid, I guess would be one way, but, you know, would be running the country eventually. And so, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution, the one with Dagami, was similar in that you get young people putting educated older people up on stands, dunce hats, killing landlords. And, you know, and the young people had a grand time. In fact, there's a couple of restaurants in Beijing that I know about where they just cater as their nostalgia restaurants for people who participated in the Cultural Revolution. It's usually when they had their first love affairs. It's they were young. They were, you know, they were together. Now they're business people, they're older. So they go to these cafes and reminisce and try to find each other and stuff like that. And there's a little bit of that late 60s stuff in the United States.
Anyway, because I don't think about it that way. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking one of the things I did for the Roberts piece was read a book that I should have read a long time ago called The Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk. And it's a brilliant book, truly is a brilliant book. He wrote it as a graduate student in Scotland in 1953. And the interesting thing about it to me is that he was not religious at the time. He later became a Catholic. So instead of religion, he said a transcendent moral order. And he had these sort of 6 points that he made. And one of them was there needs to be some kind of transcendent moral order, which I love because it doesn't have anything to do with religion. It doesn't have to be. It could be rooted in religion, but it doesn't have to be. And then the other was change happens and should happen, but it doesn't happen overnight. And it can never be forced to happen overnight. And the other thing that he said, what I think is really kind of a positive thing I wish more conservatives would understand, he talked about the beauty of diversity of life, you know, and the beauty of differences and how we should treasure differences instead of, trying to make everybody sort of uniform. So he had 6, you know, major points, all of which I can sort of agree with now, and it would have been really helpful to know about if I were capable of opening my mind enough in 1969 to look at. But yeah, so I think the reason I mention these revolutions is that I think, first of all, people confuse our American Revolution as a revolution. It was really a rebellion or a war for independence. And there were culturally, we remain the same. Basically, we were Anglo-Saxon country. And so there was no real cultural change or challenge. It was more about independence and taxation and, in some cases, slavery, because I think the Brits threatened to, as I recall, they threatened to liberate or to free any slave that fought on their side, which really inflamed the South. So there's lots of things like that. But I'm just saying, we didn't have a revolution in the same way that France did in 1789, that China did in post-Mao, in the immediate post-Mao period, post-early 1947. And revolutions, I think, are really potentially very dangerous. And one of the things that, I enjoy talking to Roberts, and we'll talk more about him later, but we both agreed on that is that the Spanish Civil War may have been more relevant to what's happening now then World War II. We made a date to, he's going to come next time he comes to Salt Lake. He's promised to have a beer with me and talk about the Spanish Civil War, which I think should be very interesting. He's a very thoughtful guy. Anyway,
do you know what the thesis is there?
Well, I know what mine is.
That's the idea that it's more important than World War II. Yeah, okay. What's yours? Because I never thought about it this way before.
It's because it was a clear contest between right and left. And the right was a dictatorship, religiously backed dictatorship. And the left was a very divided bunch of movements that were involved in, and they fought more with each other than they did with Franco. And, this was the time of the show trials and of the purges and the killings between sects of the, on the left. And to me, the left, our left is divided too in a lot of ways that are dangerous. And the right is pretty much the way it was under Franco. And I think Robert's argument would be that Franco was the right guy. You know, he was on the side of the just. And mine would be that the left was incredibly divided and ate it, you know, killed itself. So in World War II, you had more of an issue of Nazis, National Socialism, and a lot of other factors. We were allies for a good part of that with Stalin and the Soviet Union. So, I don't know. To me, the best literature, I think, came out of the Spanish Civil War. If you talk about Orwell, Orwell's stuff on Catalonia is fabulous. You have Darkness at Noon. What's
Hemingway,
his name?
Of course.
Hemingway. Oh. Hemingway was seduced by the left. I mean, Hemingway is a perfect example of somebody who sort of bought the whole left thing and ignored the divisions. So his heroes were essentially communists. But I don't know. To me, it's a fascinating period. There's the Trotskyist movement was active. There's a really good book. I think it's called The Man Who Loved Dogs or something. It's by a Cuban writer. It's about the assassination of Trotsky. But it gets into all of these issues, the inner left conflicts and so on. So I've gone on too much about that. It's just that I find that period fascinating, done a lot of reading on it. So, and Robert's agreed.
Yeah. Thanks for pivoting there. Because I don't know that much about it. So I know about other things, but that I don't know that much about. So thank you for detouring there, which I'm sure you were not even remotely thinking that we would do. You talk about revolution, and that reminds me of, I did a deep dive piece on these neo-reactionary dark enlightenment guys, which has some overlap with the Kevin Roberts crew at Heritage. And their, basically founding document is the Unabomber Manifesto, of all things. Mm-hmm. And he talks a lot in there, does Ted Kaczynski, about revolution and how, there's two things that happen in a revolution. The first is that the existing system of government is gone. And the second thing is we get to the place where we want to be that is our vision. And that second thing almost never happens, but the first thing always does. And his argument is that's the point. It's to get rid of what's there, which is kind of, scary. But that's the idea, I think, that these guys take away.
Oh, yeah. No, that is, to me, it really, really bothers me that Robertson, and I have a lot of respect for him, too, but these people who keep wielding terms like Marxist cultural, Stalinism and all these things. I mean, they're using terms that, especially when they use the term Marx in any context, that doesn't fit. I mean, if you read Marx, he would have been appalled by what happened to the Soviet Union and wouldn't have supported it. And also, I think his error is the one that you might also think of in the Spanish Civil War, in that, Marx and Engels both thought that if we had communism, the state would fade away. The state would just disappear. The people would take over. That's an enormous, going back to the Russell Kirk thesis, one of them is that, man in a broader sense. Humankind is flawed and not always good, and you can't count on it being good. You have to remember that. And it also makes it beautiful. Yeah. I mean, if you go to the Catholic medieval philosophers, I mean, they're my favorite, period. They always talk about you can't have light without darkness. You can't have moral qualities without evil. You know, they make it pretty strong argument that there has to be evil for there to be good. And so, I don't know, those things go through my mind when I listen to people talking about Marx and cultural Marxism and all these other things. It has nothing to do with Marx. It's just a misuse of him. And I think Marx and Engels would have realized that had they lived long enough.
Yeah, I feel like they use those words because they've been focus grouped to death and people respond to them. Marjorie Taylor Greene says everything's communist all the time, and communist China this and Marxist that, and none of it makes any sense. The Unabomber uses leftist. That's the word he uses. But, you know, the word woke essentially is just that. It's just another word for the same kind of boogeyman that these people are attacking, which I found linguistically interesting. So talking about the Soviets now, another place where you covered was Afghanistan. So you covered it when the Russians had it. You covered it when the Taliban was there. You covered it when we were there. It's obviously a fascinating place. What did you think about, when Biden decided to withdraw the troops? What was your take on that as somebody who knows the area really well?
I was totally for withdrawing the troops from Afghanistan. But, Afghanistan, before the Soviet invasion in 1979, I guess, was a place that played both sides really well. In other words, it was all about foreign aid. And the people who were in charge in Kabul were very skillful at playing the Soviets against the Americans. And it really benefited them in a lot of ways. You got one university built by the Americans, another university built by the Soviets, the hydroelectric project in the Kandahar province, built by the Soviets, the agricultural irrigation projects in Herat and other places were built by the Americans. You know, you had American professors, Soviet professors. You had a lot going on, and the beneficiary was Afghanistan. The Soviets foolishly invaded, thinking that they had a potential communist government in Kabul. They invaded and they assassinated the leader, and they installed their own guy, Kamal. You know, they produced a disaster for Afghanistan, because then it became us against the Soviets. The Afghan war is a proxy for the Cold War. The Mujahideen, you know, in Afghanistan before didn't have that kind of fundamentalist bent. The main butt of jokes in Afghanistan were the mullahs, were the imams. You know, then you bring in fundamentalists, and Americans bring them in. They referred to Osama bin Laden as that nice young man. You know, they bring them in to fight on the side of the Afghans. Mujahideen, they create the Mujahideen. We created our own problem. So, I don't know. I think it's a tragedy, and it's been a tragedy since that original invasion by the Soviets, and our failure to do the right thing, which is to support them with their infrastructure and go back to a foreign aid model. Our failure to do that, especially after the Soviet war, after the Soviets withdrew. I mean, I rode out of Afghanistan on a Soviet tank. It was one of the cooler moments.
Oh my
of
God! Okay.
They had staged this. Soviets had staged this withdrawal, and they wanted it witnessed. So they invited some foreign journalists to go on the. It was orchestrated by the KGB chief, Polyanko. It was later assassinated. But so they flew us up to Mazar Sharif in helicopters, and then we got on tanks and rode across the French bridge into Uzbekistan. And it was like the coolest ride I've ever been on, because Afghanistan has terrible roads. So, but those tractor treads on tanks are really smooth. So, you know, it was really wonderful riding along on top of a Soviet tank, looking at these beautiful mountains.
So you weren't in the tank. You were on top of it?
Yeah, yeah.
You were on the tank or in the tank?
There was no real danger.
No, I didn't think so. Okay.
It was a staged withdrawal. Yeah. I guess you could have had Massoud or somebody take a pot shot. Well, they might have, but I mean, among the many times I've been in Afghanistan, that was probably the safest the most fun. But, you know, after that, instead of coming in and, you know, spending a little bit of money, a tiny bit of money, to restore the country, to help build up its institutions, we just abandoned it. And even people who supported the Mujahideen movement as a proxy, like Timber Charlie Wilson of Texas, former congressman, they knew it too, and they tried to get some aid. And instead, we just abandoned them. And then, of course, that created a petri dish for the Arabs who had been left there, who had been part of the Mujahideen, had their own forces, and for the Pakistanis to play their mischief. Pakistan's main issue in Afghanistan is that that the Pashtuns, who are the majority, not create a separate state. So their main goal is to avoid Pashtunistan. And so that's why they support the most radical fundamentalist leaders. And that's been the case. And we just handed over the keys to Afghanistan to Pakistan totally. Even when we were there, even during the war, the Soviet war, we were totally dependent on their intelligence operation. They choose the people that we supported. So instead of Massoud, it was Hikmat Yar and all these other people. Anyway, I'm too much in the weeds on that, but I did spend a lot of time there in all sorts of different...
No, it's fascinating. We like the weeds on this podcast.
Well, one more thing I would mention is that if I were to sum up the problem with Afghanistan, it's mostly about the women. And if you go back to the original reason that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, is because the puppet that they had, a guy named Taraki, they had in Kabul, had issued a bunch of decrees modeled on the Soviet decrees, one of which was education for women compulsory education for women. And that led to a big rebellion in Herat, which caused the Soviets to have to send in attack bombers and then ultimately removed Taraki and replaced him with somebody else. But the issue was at the beginning was women, and I've written about this in a book that hasn't been published, but the original group of Americans who were American journalists who went into Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion. So this was like in January of 1980. It was a CIA-sponsored trip into Afghanistan to meet with the rebel leaders. I mean, we didn't participate knowing that it was but clearly in retrospect it is. And the reporters who went in, including New York Times, Washington Post, etc., not me, but they went in, and it was a horrendous trip into the heart of Afghanistan. They had to hide under blankets in the back of a truck and travel only at night, and it was freezing cold. It took 2 days, and it was horrible, and you know, they had dysentery, whatever. They finally get to the caves in the mountains up east of Herat. They get to the caves where the rebel leaders are assembled, and they go through the whole process. They present a bunch of primitive weapons that they've collected, you know, British rifles, and one guy holds a rock like he's, you know, David versus Goliath. They do the whole staged up thing. And then the reporters are just miserable because they're cold and they've been through hell to get there. All they want is the interview with the rebel leader. And so they go in, they have a translator. It's complicated because the translator has to use Dari, which is their version of Persian, but the people he's interviewing are Pashtuns. And so there was all kind of a complicated thing. But when they finally interview the guy, one of the reporters says, "So tell us, why you've taken on the Great Red Army. What is the reason for it? And the guy said instantly, they are trying to educate our women, which kind of ruined the whole trip. But the odd, and this is a disgrace actually, but not one of the reporters who was there mentioned that as being the first line of the.
Wow.
In retrospect, but they all told the story. The reason I know about it is it was great barroom chat. You know, they love telling that story. And then what happened? Because generally, journalism is better in bars than it is in papers anyway.
Right.
There's some things you can hear and you know are true, but you can't write about. Yes.
I'm just going to say, it just kept happening. I mean, first you had the bloody violence. I think they killed like 20 Soviet advisors in Herat in 1979 before the Soviets came in. And it just kept happening. And when the Najibullah regime and the communist-backed regimes that followed, Kemal, Najibullah, these other people, in Kabul, they had they had equality, and so afforded equality between the sexes. But in the rural areas, like it is in Texas, there was a lot of opposition to it. So you had the typical urban-rural divide. And then, of course, that was the thing that the Taliban exploited in order to get into power, basically. It was a return to putting women in their place. But also during our participation in the war against the Soviets, we were encouraging people who were doing that. And we actually helped in the printing of books that described men as the true leaders and so on. So later on said, well, they need to treat the women better. But then during that time when we were fighting the Soviet Union, we're using them as a proxy. Anything was game, and they just, they exploited it and helped create that atmosphere. So, and I don't think it stopped. Yeah. I mean, if you go back now, it's the same thing now in Kabul as it was, and in the end, the people who are both symbolic of the problems and who are the victims of it are women. So I would just say the main thing is, it's always, my line would be, it's always been about the women. I don't know. That's totally true.
No, I think it's accurate. I read a couple of books about Afghanistan in the rise of the Taliban period. And apparently, according to the book that I read, the treatment of women with all the honor rape stuff and all that really horrible stuff was so terrible that the Taliban actually improved it by at least protecting everybody better. Which is so horrifying to think of. So I think you're right. You also mentioned at the beginning that Russia foolishly invaded Afghanistan. I think the last invasion of Afghanistan that was not foolish was done by what, Alexander the Great something? It's never a good idea. You know, the British got their asses kicked in the 19th century. It's just bad.
Yeah.
Just don't do it.
Well, one thing that is really interesting, and there's a great new book, but it's by former diplomat, really prominent diplomat, Peter Thompson. It's called The Wars of Afghanistan. The reason that that book is so great is that all of the notes from the Politburo meetings that led up to the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets were released. And so most books leading before that did not have the internal debate inside of the Soviet Union. And there was a huge debate. And it was really a divisive thing. And it was, I think Brezhnev who made the final decision, but there was opposition and there was a recorded opposition within the poem. So it was touch and go. The KGB, we took one position, the GSI took another. So you have, which is the military intelligence unit. And what's the beauty of this book and the modern new research is not only can we see a lot of what happened on the American side and but you get into the heart of Soviet decisions with documents I never dreamed would ever be available. So when I say foolish, it's because it was not necessarily going to happen. It was debated and the wrong side.
I just went, when you went to your bookshelf, I went to mine, and the book that I'm talking about is called The Fragmentation of Afghanistan by Barnett Rubin. I don't even know why I have that book. I bought it in the bookstore. Okay, so this is a good time to take a short break. We'll be right back with Roan Tempest.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/Greg. You know, a common misconception about relationships is that they have to be easy to be right. Therapy can be a place to work through the challenges you face in all of your relationships, whether with friends, work, your significant other, anyone. I mean, we live in a world now where a lot of our social interactions take place online, which is strange, right? Because for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, human beings have been on this earth. There's not been Facebook or Twitter, you know, for all this time. And now suddenly we've had to adapt to how to deal with this, and stuff comes up online because you know this person, you think you know that person. It's very confusing. You know, there's no template for it. We've never had this challenge in all the time that we human beings have been here. So who do you go to talk to about that? In my case, I went to BetterHelp, and it helped me a lot. It really helped me get through a hard time in my life. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. One of the nice things, it's entirely online, which is great actually for therapy, because I feel like sometimes there's an awkwardness in going somewhere and you have to go find somebody and you have to talk to the... It just takes a long time to get therapy going. It's hard to find a good therapist. So with BetterHelp, you don't have to wait nearly as long. You fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched up with a licensed therapist. You can switch if you need to, but you're going pretty quickly. And when you're out looking for a therapist, it's usually because you need a therapist. You want to talk to somebody, you know, sooner rather than later. So that's a great benefit of BetterHelp. It's flexible, it's convenient, it's suited to your schedule. I used to do my my sessions in my car on my phone, like at lunch hour, and it worked fine. It worked great, and it really helped me. It helped me get through a rough patch in my life, and it can help you too. So become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Roan Tempest. Now, you wrote the piece about Kevin Roberts in Wyophile, which you're the co-founder of. So before we get into Kevin, and I promise we are going to get into Kevin, talk a little bit about Wyophile, what it is, why you founded it, what the mission is, and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you for doing that, because that gives me an opportunity to talk about Wyophile, which has really been a huge success. I'm really happy with it. But what happened is that I, quote, retired from the LA Times, and, thinking that I had retired, but discovering that if you have a brain, you can't really retire. I mean, how do you do it? You stop thinking? I don't know. So, and I couldn't help but write about what I was seeing. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity to do that. And it was just to be, I worked as a consultant with ProPublica, and this model of the nonprofit model, it was coming. And I could see that it might be a way around the broken business model of journalism. And it was clear that ProPublica was going to work on a national level. But there was also room for it to work at a local level. And so in 2008, I was retired to my place in Wyoming, which we'd had for a long time, where I, in between assignments, we'd go to Wyoming. I gathered together some journalists and people, writers and so on that I knew or knew of in Wyoming. And we got some money from a guy in Colorado who was hoping to replicate the Democratic revival of Colorado and Wyoming, which turns out wasn't a really great idea for a lot of different reasons. But he gave us a bunch of money to start out with. And we didn't know exactly what we were, but we knew we were the future somehow. So we experimented with different things, columns. I did a number of investigative pieces, which got a huge response. I mean, the place didn't have a lot of investigative reporting, and it was very rewarding. And then we got some other foundational grants, and people started following it. And it really took off after I left as editor and moved to Salt Lake for medical reasons. We just needed to be closer to healthcare. Now it's really, I think, maybe the most important single news source in Wyoming. And it's got a lot of integrity. It does in-depth stuff. It has a staff, which we didn't really have before. It's got a budget over $1 million. And to put that into perspective, the budget of my bureau in Paris was about $700,000, I think. That was for one person with a researcher. And I didn't get paid that. My researcher actually got paid more, because of French work rules. That was one person doing, stories about France and, feature stories about truffles or whatever. $700,000 with $1 million. With $1 million, you can have a staff. You can put out a regular report you can cover. And that's because of the internet. It's because of one of the biggest expenses in the Paris Bureau was the telephone. It was a couple $100,000 a year just to have a telephone. All of these things. And the one reason I have some hope for the future of journalism is things like this podcast, for example. But that so many different things have made it a lot easier to do a really good job. I mean, just take your access to all the libraries and everything in the world instantaneously, no matter where you are.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a nice one.
And then there's basically free telephones. Then there's transcription. You can't imagine how much time I spent transcribing things as a reporter when I was younger. And now...
I'm sure. I used to... Yeah.
Well, and And now these transcriptions are instantaneous, and you have the actual tape to use too. So things have been made a lot easier and cheaper, and so that gives me some hope. But anyway, Wildfowl was a pioneer in that in 2008, and to my great joy, it's been a pretty good, you know, been a success. It does a really good job on environmental issues. It covered the legislature like the Dew and Dixie this last time around. It's really a pleasure to watch. And they do occasional pieces like the Roberts piece that I did, that basically I assigned myself, but still, you know, if something comes along and you say, this guy's going to be really important, this guy's going to really be important. Yeah. And he used to live in Wyoming. We need to find out who he is and where he comes from.
Yes.
And so the timing was good. And that's how that happened. But it wouldn't have happened without something like Wildfowl to do it. And as you know, there's Wildfowls all over the place now. Some are good, some are better than others. A lot are great. Yeah. I think they work.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely work in this case. And for people listening who are wondering, and I think you just said it, why are we talking about Wyoming? It's because, as you said, Kevin Roberts lived in Wyoming, and he was the president of Wyoming Catholic College, which is in Lander, Wyoming, and basically took that little kind of new college that nobody had heard of and put it on the map because I think he's very good at publicity. And he also did the thing where he rejected the federal money and made that into a story that was covered by the New York Times. And then it, you know, his career sort of blossomed from there. But Wyoming itself, before we get to him, I keep saying before we get to him, this is important, though. Talk a little bit about the political landscape there, because it's confusing to me. It's always seemed like it's been a little bit bipartisan in some ways, where they have these political figures on both sides of the aisle who kind of know each other and they're friendly and they work well together. And sometimes there's liberal stuff, like in your book, you talk about Nellie Taylor Ross in 1927, who's the woman governor of Wyoming, which is, you know, that's amazing.
First governor.
If you stop and
first
think
governor.
About it. Women could only vote in 1920, you know, so that's astonishing. But now, and then I always thought Liz Cheney was kind of like this embodiment of what kind of represented there. But Matt Gaetz came to Wyoming and said, you must reject Liz Cheney. And Wyoming rejected Liz Cheney. So what's going on there? What happened with that? Like, what am I not seeing?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And still, to me, is a mystery in a lot of ways. I mean, I spent part of my childhood in Wyoming and then later came back after some years overseas. So I spent part of my early childhood, grade school in Laramie, and then came back to Wyoming in 1994 or something. We bought a house. I always thought of it, and a lot of this just surprises me. I always thought of it as a pretty tolerant place, you know, a laissez-faire kind of state where you minded your own business, but you didn't make a lot of judgments about other people. And it didn't have a race issue. I mean, there was, I think, is still only less than 2% of the population is maybe less than 1% is African American. You did have a huge, big Indian population, a lot of problems there, prejudice there. But generally speaking, I thought it was a kind of a place where you could say what you thought. You could sort of be what you thought, what you wanted to be, and it elected people, right and left, mostly right. Even the Democrats that they elected would be on the right side. But
yeah.
You know, when I first went there after I retired, Dave Friedenthal was the Democratic governor. You had the great guy that I mentioned in my book, who was a 3-term governor. And it was Democrat. So you had the ability to elect, especially in those days, sometimes you could elect a Democratic governor and have Republican national representatives. That was pretty common. Then somehow, I would say in the pre-Trump period, but it was suddenly, I think Wyoming became a destination the way that the panhandle of Idaho was for conservative right-wing people to seek refuge. It has almost no power. You know, it's only 600,000 people. So, and two United States senators. And I think they started to get an in-migration of people like that panhandle of Idaho. And then I started hearing people talking too loudly at post offices, basically bragging, making kind of political pronouncements like they were just having a conversation. And then people who had been longtime respected, like Al Simpson, and, was a Republican, bipartisan guy. These people started getting dissed. And then you had sort of establishment right-wing people like the Cheneys getting dissed and losing. So somehow things have gone. I did a profile of the Democratic Party leader in Wyoming, a guy named E. Thorne. Somehow the movement got taken over. And then the other element that is, as far as I'm concerned, is pretty new to Wyoming is religion. Religion never really played a factor, in my memory. It was still a missionary state for the Catholics. There was a large Mormon presence, which tended to be pretty conservative, but relatively isolated in the western part of the state. No Catholics to speak of. We went to an Episcopal church when I was a kid in Laramie. I mean, it was just typical coffee and donut kind of thing. The minister drives a Buick. I mean, there was nothing, there's no, and abortion? Hello? I mean, it really would have been, okay. I mean, big deal. So suddenly it is, and suddenly you see them doing these things that are totally alien to me, and I can't totally explain it, except that there has been an in-migration. There are some things that have happened that are really disturbing. The white population voted against Obama in the same percentage as it did in Mississippi and Alabama, maybe higher. I can't remember. I did a statistical analysis of it. I mean, where does race enter into what they, it's totally alien to the place. It doesn't have any black people. So it's a mystery to me. I think there's been recently, though, a division within the Republican Party and fighting back. This last session of the legislature, which just ended, was one of the most contentious. And the fact it was contentious is a good thing. I mean, it means that there's opposition to the extreme. Yeah. My cousin was Speaker of the House years ago. He was a Republican, but, environmentalist. I mean, it's just a kind of a mystery.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. It may be coming around. People are going to have to stand up, and some are. So, and then you have a couple of good, WildFile there. You have some institutions that can support civil discourse. Anyway, I don't know. It's a mystery.
Yeah, because I'm just saying, I really thought if the Republicans nationally were going to get rid of Trump and coalesce behind somebody, Liz Cheney was right there. If Liz Cheney was running for president right now and backed by the Republicans, she would win easily. Easily, I think. So, whatever. They screwed themselves out of that, strategically. So Kevin Roberts is from Louisiana. He's a scholar. He has a PhD in history. He wrote his dissertation on slave culture in Louisiana, which I read part of it. It's very interesting, actually. I'm sure you at least looked at it writing the profile, which is why I found out that this had occurred. He is a Catholic, and I think an extreme Catholic. I grew up Catholic, so it's important for me to differentiate between the Leonard Leo kind of extremist radical Catholics, which Robert seems to be one of those, rather than the mainstream Catholics that I grew up with and that I know. So that belief system seems to be permeating his work. But my first question is, what's he like in person? Because I think you said in the piece he's a nice guy. He seems like he's a nice guy.
Well, this is one of these rare moments in my life, anyway, where I'm profiling a neighbor. Before, I before I even thought of him as the subject of a story, I was living next to him. And, we lived a few hundred feet from each other. You know, maybe 1,000, but he lived at what we used to call a witness protection house, which is way up on top of the hill above ours, on the foothills of the Wind River Mountains. And kind of a cool neighborhood. Another journalist, really prominent, good guy, Ben Goes, lives across the street. Most of the people were there with the National Outdoor Leadership School,
Knowles,
which is
right.
Knowles. Yeah, Knowles. So, and then in that context, as a neighbor, he was a terrific neighbor. I mean, he attended water. We had water port meetings. We had road meetings. We had snowplow meetings. We had, he had a beautiful family. His kids were, it was kind of a joy to drive by there because they seemed like they were almost always outdoors climbing something. You know, and personally, and his wife, Michelle, fabulous. And one neighbor, I think, I might have mentioned this to you, but one neighbor said, Kevin Roberts is the only guy I really like but disagree about everything. You know, he's one of those people. Now, it may be that one thing I like about conservative intellectuals, if they really are intellectuals, is that they can have, as Roberts does, enough confidence in their position that they are not going to go crazy when somebody opposes that position.
Challenges them.
And Robert, yeah, challenges them. And Roberts historically has been a debater, champion debater in Louisiana. And, you know, he's open, as was another guy that I profiled, Victor Davis Hanson. These are people who are smart enough, educated enough, grounded enough in their position that they can defend it without getting angry. And Roberts told me that one of his goals is to have people not be as angry. Then again, he turns around and does all this polemic jargon and, you know, catchphrases.
Yeah. Stuff to make us angry, yes.
Well, the people that knew him as and were his colleagues in graduate school, you know, were shocked when he started doing this stuff because, yeah, he was a conservative. He didn't change. But he was not the kind that you would see using these techniques. Now, and I actually don't think even now it sounds very natural when he does it. You know, it sounds sort of stiff. I shared the story with a writer, Tom McGuane. You know Tom McGuane, writer? He's up in Montana.
Yeah.
And he and I correspond, and he watched one of the videos that was in that piece of Roberts, I think it was talking at the World Trade event, and Roberts says something like, I think it's really funny. And McGuane says, it doesn't seem natural. It wasn't funny. It had nothing to do with being funny. You know, it's just, and it's a strategy that he's adopted, I think. I don't know what he would think about me saying this, but I don't really care, but it doesn't seem natural. It doesn't fit the person. But I think that they feel, just as they feel about Trump, that if you're going to win, you have to do stuff like that. And so it seems alien to me when he uses these phrases, because I know him as a neighbor and as somebody who is capable of a really, you know, deep, and I think even saying that he's wrong about something. He hasn't taken the step that I would like to see more of among conservatives of with the pack on issues. For example, his godfather, Russell Kirk, you know, the guy that wrote The Conservative Mind, a brilliant guy. Mm-hmm. He voted for a socialist for president 1 year. He voted for McCarthy on this, McCarthy's fourth attempt at the presidency. He opposed our policy toward Israel, not Israel itself. And so did Buchanan. And what I haven't seen from Roberts, I asked him specifically if there's ways in which he breaks from the pack. And the only thing he could come up with is that he would support federal aid for people who have children. And he said that the model for that was Viktor Orban and Israel, and you know, subsidies for having children. But I mean, I didn't really think that as a break, not to the extent that voting for a socialist is. And you know, both Roberts and I celebrate people like the Longstreet, the Confederate general who fought in the Civil War, was Lee's right-hand man, and then worked with Grant on Reconstruction. So, and Justice Harlan, for example, the other one, who was the sole voice against the Massey-Ferguson separate but equal case, a Southerner from a slaveholding family. So you always look for, I always look for people who have positions or opinions, but who are willing to take a, to break with it occasionally. And I've been waiting for Kevin to do that. I don't know if he will. I didn't see much of it.
I think his position, I mean, his position now, he's in charge of the Heritage Place. That's an old organization that's been around for obviously a long time and has been very, very influential, but he isn't. He's not coming at it. This is just my read on it. He's not coming at it from a position of, you know, he was the deputy White House, whatever. He ran that, he ran the college and worked in Texas at that policy place briefly before taking this job. And I think also with this Project 2025, his job really isn't to stand out. His job is to take all of the viewpoints and squeeze them together into something uniform and coherent. At least that's how I read the Project 2025, mostly from his forward. It seems like, you know, the vision is, let's get these thinkers, these conservative thought leaders, so-called, on these various topics and cram all this stuff together, and I'm going to make sense of it in a coherent way. So somebody like that probably is less likely to be an outlier on any of the policies, because it makes his job harder. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, what they're trying to do is what they did in 1979, 1980 for Reagan. They're trying to be there on the ground floor, and they felt like they missed the boat in the 2016 election, because nobody knew that Trump would win, and so they weren't prepared for his victory. In fact, quite the opposite. And as a result, Trump appointed all these people that he saw on Fox News to important positions. And they, in their opinion, they lost an opportunity to affect policy, and that they're not going to lose it again. And I mean, to his credit, they've been all in on Trump from the very beginning, practically. And he wasn't that clear to me. Wasn't that clear to me that he had it in his back pocket. So they went all in, and they have gone all in, and they're in a very similar position with a Trump administration as they were in 1979 with the incoming Reagan administration. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think they've dedicated almost everything to this big gamble that that they're going to be needed, and that they'll have a position. And I think an accurate understanding that Trump doesn't really care about that sort of stuff, and more than willing to hand it over.
Yeah.
Other than pomp and circumstance of the presidency, doesn't care about anything. So they're taking advantage. Yeah. They're hoping to take advantage of him, and they're hoping to do what they've dreamed about doing since Goldwater, I guess. So, which is to seize control of the country, both culturally and politically.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, that's the thing. You mentioned it at the top of the interview that, you know, this does feel like a cultural revolution, which I don't know what the definition of that would be, but a small minority of zealots foisting their own belief system on the rest of the country who doesn't believe in it or want it. That seems like a cultural revolution to me, where you have to, you know, literally change the culture. And for a guy that I can't get over the fact that these supposedly religious Christian people are in with Trump, who's clearly evil. I mean, clearly, my mother asked me years ago, do you think Trump is the Antichrist? And she wasn't kidding. She was completely serious. I mean, he exhibits every trait that they should hate, and yet they're willing to go in with him to, you know, affect these changes, which will, you know, flat out hurt a lot of people, frankly. in ways that are horrible and, again, antithetical to the Christianity that I grew up learning about. So, I don't know. It's all very strange to me.
No, I agree. I mean, and I asked him about it. He was basically, you know, we all know that Trump is a means to an end. He's the vessel, you know, that they're going to use. And we should recognize also, as Roberts does, that he's a very gifted, Trump is a very gifted physical comedian an entertainer. No, I think often about this beautiful family that Roberts has in Mar-a-Lago, just thinking, oh my God, would he expose them to that? And I can't think that he would. You know, he says Trump is a nice guy, but, you know, it's just, the word cynical comes to mind. I mean, they won't use the expression means to an end. And there's a good reason for that, because the left used to use that too. But they will use this kind of idea that he's just a useful tool to get into power. And they're willing to, you know, I think Robert said to me, you know, we're not electing the pastor of our church. You know, we're electing somebody that we can get our agenda done. And, you know, I think they bought into that. And they may be, if anybody's going to do it, if anybody's going to get him into position, whether or not they could implement these policies, I don't have the slightest idea. But if anybody's going to get them in the position of doing that, it would be Trump, probably, because of his wide appeal. It's really a close presidential race.
I know. The other thing is that, you know, when you have Leonard Leo, who is all over Heritage, I think Tom Carter told me that of the 80 groups that are involved with it, Leonard Leo funds 40 of them. So that belief system, the really the anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ, anti-contraception, even that they're veering in this direction now, and that stuff is never going to take hold in the United States unless there's a dictator. We just won't. People don't want it. Yeah. So what's your read on Project 2025? Because I don't like to throw words around when I don't mean them, but reading what I read of it, it does seem to have Christian nationalist undertones. It does seem to be kind of a playbook for how to start a fascist dictatorship in 100 days or whatever. Am I wrong about that? Is it hyperbole? Like, what do you think?
I haven't read it as carefully as you have, probably, but I think there's been a lot of detail work done on it. And these people are a lot smarter than the people who Trump had in his first administration. But like you, I don't get the religious aspect of it. And I think it's a loser. And I think that's in one way in which Roberts isn't the ideal person to be running Heritage. His Catholic background and his position on abortion and families is certainly consistent with conservative Catholicism, but it's not the kind of thing that wins elections. And I don't think it's something he's going to abandon or moderate. And so, if they really wanted to take over the country, I think that is probably their ambition, as it would be probably for any think tank. But if they want to take over the policy aspect of government, they certainly wouldn't do it that way, I don't think, for the reasons you said. And so I think you're going to get into this bind. If they're not in it now, they will be in the future, where, you know, the things that they hold most dear, such as right to life, et cetera, whatever they want to call it, are going to work in the American public. And haven't been. So if they were to do, our country is veering out of control. There's too much violence. The border's out of control. Immigration is a problem. It's too expensive. I'd like to drive big trucks. You know, those things would work and work better. So in some ways, I think, in the way in which he is truly religious, I don't think he's necessarily a good fit for achieving their goals. I don't think of Heritage as, maybe you think of it more as religious. organization than I do. I think of it as a sort of culturally conservative place.
I agree. And that's why it's odd. I agree. You're right. It is odd that he is in there now and that the religious stuff is bled into Heritage, which seemed to be like made up of what I used to call money Republicans rather than religious Republicans.
Oh, yeah. That's over. That's over. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, the shift on the national level has occurred also in the Heritage Foundation. There's no question. I don't know where it takes us. I just know what I know is that this guy is only 49 years old. That's a very young man.
Yeah.
From where I come from. I think you're 49 too, aren't you? But
I'm 51. He's younger than me. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a kid. Well, I'm 77, and I kept feeling those years when I was talking to him, because I kept feeling his youth. In a lot of ways, you know, his kids haven't rebelled yet. You know, he hasn't encountered frustration or disappointment in a lot of ways. And, you know, the key to his, who he is, I think, is goes back to Louisiana, to his background. And, I think that was the one really great thing that I was able to get out of that profile, was sort of his roots. And he was open about it, which is, these people are pretty, nobody had ever profiled him, ever, in any kind of depth. So he grew up in poverty and in a broken, badly broken family. Alcoholic father, divorced family when he was 3 years old. Brother commits suicide when he's 15. When he's 9 years old, his brother's 15. No money, going from cheap apartment in Lafayette to another one. Mother loses her job. So what does he do? I think the natural thing would be clutch onto the institutions that give him comfort. And so it was the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts and school. And he was in public school. He never was in parochial school. And he excelled at those things, and he realized that he could, but he still had kind of a chip on his shoulder. And he was very open and vulnerable to Pat Buchanan and these other people that talked about families and the sanctity of family, and because he didn't have one. It was something that he was hungry for and resonated. And he spent most of his time thinking about with his own family, actually keeping them intact. And I think successfully so. But I don't know. I just think, given that background, it's hard for people who had an easier personal history to understand where he's coming from. Then you have to understand who he is. You have to understand that horrible period where he was nobody. He couldn't even get into LSU. He had to go to University of Louisiana, Lafayette. It used to be called Southwest Louisiana. It was a scholarship kid. And it also explains his ambition, tremendous ambition.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't even object when I used his salary in the story. Because, you know, it's a point of pride how he's progressed from nothing to 600. Sure. And it's something he wouldn't mind having advertised, I think. So I think he's extremely ambitious. I think he's very grateful to the church and to civil organizations, the Boy Scouts, certain schools. He's grateful to them for sort of being a life raft. And I think it's hard for anybody else to understand what he went through who hasn't been through it himself. So anyway, I was sympathetic to that part of his history and impressed by the way that he handled it. His scholarship is fascinating. It's an odd subject for him to choose, but one of the main things that he accomplished was, his main goal was, like with his life in a way, I think, was to show how organizations and how institutions saved the worst part of slavery from affecting people in some cases. One of his heroes in this dissertation is a Catholic priest in New Orleans He makes a distinction between the way the Spanish treated slaves and the way that the French treated slaves in the English. So he goes really deep into that. It's a subject I don't think he would have chosen. I mean, he once described it, he was regretted saying it, but as politically correct. I think he would have chosen another subject, probably, but his scholarship is impeccable, as far as I'm told by people who really know the subject. And he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, I think, again, you do a great job in the profile, because you're not out to attack him or anything like that. You're just, you know, you played it very even handed. I think you did a wonderful job with it. So I don't know. Have you talked to him since it ran? Did he like it, or do you not know?
Yeah, he did. He said.
Okay. Yeah.
He said it was fair and objective. And he had one complaint, which I had the year of his parents' divorce wrong. So I had to fix that. One, it was just a date. But he said he was fair and objective as he knew it would be. And that's pretty, I thought it was high praise. And I don't think I left anything out that needed to be in there. On the other hand, I didn't misrepresent him. I don't think so. If you can do that,
I think you did a great job. Yeah.
I love profiling these right wingers, so who are thoughtful. So
I wrote a thing about the neo-reactionary people who are like the quote unquote thought leaders. It is interesting to go down the rabbit holes, even to push your own brain, be like, okay, why do they think this? Why do I think the opposite? You know, how do we get there? I don't know. I think it's good to challenge your own belief systems every once in a while by reading, you know, counter arguments. I don't think it's a terrible thing an intellectual exercise or a moral one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So we're coming up on time. I don't want to keep you much longer. I have one more question for you. You also, you were out in Sacramento for a while too, for the LA Times. As we're recording this, it's now going to be Adam Schiff against Steve Garvey. I haven't heard the name Steve Garvey since 1983. You have any insight on what's going to happen? Like, is the slick fielding first baseman thing going to help him take on Schiff in the Senate? I don't know. I know that you have a cat named Rusty Staub, so I know that you must be some amount of a baseball fan.
The cat is named Rusty Staub because he's orange, and you remember Rusty Staub when he was at Montreal was called Luc Rolde Orange. I don't have any idea, but I mean, Schiff is a really attractive candidate for California. He's been a great spokesman for the state through the impeachment hearings. He's a, you know, constant presence on MSNBC, which is sort of a California's flagship network, I would think. And Garvey's, you know, a former baseball player with some history that's not positive. And also, Schiff did a good political thing. He was able to encourage there to be a Garvey Schiff contest as opposed to the two other Democratic candidates for the position. And they were both, you know, pretty good. And by eliminating, he avoided having it become a Democrat v. Democrat election. And so it's ideal for Schiff. I don't think Garvey, what I can tell, is as slick in the political arena as he was at first base. And we'll just have to see that. I'd be shocked. On the other hand, I thought Liz Cheney had a chance in Wyoming. So you can't really, and I never thought Trump would win in 2016.
I agree on both of those points, for sure. So, okay, again, it's Wyofile, which is W-Y-O file, F-I-L-E. Please check that out. Also, your book that I read is called The Last Western, The Unjustified Killing of Michael Rosa by Ed Cantrell, which is kind of like you go into this deep dive into this murder that happened in the late 70s, and it goes into Wyoming politics and history, and you know, fascinating. I think people that like this, like cold case kind of stuff would enjoy it. So please go check that out. Roan Tempest, it was great to meet you. Thanks so much for hanging out with me today.
thanks for asking me, and good luck with all of this in your program and your writing. And talk to you soon, I hope. Stay in touch.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fossa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Be kind to each other. Try and enjoy yourself. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.